100th anniversary, the centenary of the end of the Great War. It's a commemoration, of course, and we've covered that from all kinds of angles. And we've spoken to many people who make the point that the Great War kind of gave us the 20th century in all its horrors, in all its technological advances. It also gave us, you could say almost directly, Adolf Hitler. And coincidentally, 100 years ago last week, a 29-year-old Adolf Hitler was rushed, supposedly blind, to a German hospital. What happened next may have changed his personality forever. It's a remarkable story, and I'm delighted to welcome back to Talk Radio one of the country's leading psychologists, a neuropsychologist and author, Dr. David Lewis. Good morning, David, and thank you for doing this for us.
Good morning, Paul. Lovely to speak with you again.
It was about 14, 15 years ago I read your remarkable first book. You've written many others, but first book about Hitler, the man who invented Hitler, and that talked about this treatment for his almost hysterical blindness. What's changed since then? What happened to Hitler around that time?
It's a very interesting story because up to October 1918, which is when he went blind in a British gas attack in Belgium. And up to that point, he'd been a pretty indifferent soldier. I mean, he'd not been an uncourageous soldier. He was noted for his courage. He won the Iron Cross first class. But he had no leadership qualities. In fact, in court, years later, one of the officers who'd been in command of him, the prosecuting counsel said to him, well, why didn't you ever promote Hitler? Because he was never more than a lance corporal, kind of the lowest rank you can get. And he said, because he showed no leadership qualities. He couldn't lead men, which was a little bit absurd.
And he had been a real failure, hadn't he, up to the war? He was a homeless, vagrant, penniless. He was trying to sell his watercolours, which are rather poor daubs, and he'd lost his mother, I think, to breast cancer. So he'd had a kind of very low-achieving life until then.
Absolutely. He'd been a purposeless drifter in the streets of Vienna. He'd lived rough on the streets. He'd lived in doss houses. He kind of grafted for a living, as you were saying, by painting pretty indifferent pictures. He failed to get into the academy, which was what his ambition was, to become an artist, to become a great painter. And he really just drifted. And even at the end of the war, he'd not done anything. He'd not achieved anything. And then suddenly he has this transformation. And what I argue in the book is that he had his transformation as a result of meeting a doctor called Dr. Edmund Forster, who was a nerve, what they used to call in those days, a nerve specialist, because Hitler had been diagnosed with being blind, truly, but not blind because his eyes had been irreparably damaged by gas, by mustard gas, say, but because he'd had a psychological breakdown, what we would call today a post-traumatic stress
disorder. Because he'd been in the army since he enlisted, like on the day war was declared, I think, didn't he?
Pretty much in August 14, yes. He enlisted. He fought throughout. He was wounded once, went to hospital with a physical injury. But on that occasion, the doctors at the front realised that his eyes hadn't been significantly damaged. He was blind. He wasn't kind of malingering, as many perhaps tried to do. He simply could not see, but he could not see psychologically. And as a psychologist, that's obviously where my interest lay.
And the new book is called Triumph of the Will? What new research has emerged? What have you learned in the 14, 15 years since that original book, which is a must-read as well, folks, called The Man Who Invented Hitler? What new research has come through, David? What's your new thesis?
I had a website up since launching the book in 2004, and I've had a lot of information from people who fought alongside Hitler, who were relatives of those who knew him when he was coming to power, and who actually were involved in his medical treatment. So with all this new information, I also came across another, because what I argue in the book is he actually was exposed to hypnosis. A Foster hypnotized him. He told him, and this is how he got his sight back, he told him that his eyes had been irreparably damaged. That wasn't true, but that's what he told him. Most people, for that kind of damage, would be blind for life. And so he was likely to remain blind for life. But occasionally, he said, a great man is born into the world, Jesus or a Muhammad, and they have the power to kind of subvert nature. And if you are this special kind of person who has special destiny in the world, then you'll get your sight back. And of course, he did. And that convinced him that for every step he took, and he actually said that, every step he took from then on was kind of dictated, not by God. He didn't really believe in God, but he did believe in some kind of supernatural power.
In fact, in kind of his own fate, him being the kind of arrow point of history, almost.
Exactly so, yes. It was what we call in leadership studies a crucible moment. It was a moment which transformed, literally gave him back his sight and gave him a vision of how he might kind of take Germany, or make, to quote a phrase, make Germany great again by leading her from the sort of abject defeat of 1918 through to glory. And that's really what he saw his mission as. And in he then met another hypnotist, a fascinating character I've not encountered in the first book, who was called Erich Hirschman. And he was actually a Moravian Jew masquerading as, in very dangerous thing to do, but masquerading in Berlin, of all places, as a Danish aristocrat.
And a clairvoyant, I think, because I know the Nazis had a fascination with the occult, with the paranormal. In that way, they thought there were other powers they could tap into. But the fact guy was of Jewish heritage is astonishing, this man, because I think he met Hitler first, in 1931, according to your book.
That's correct, yes. He was a very famous celebrity. He played at the major, the La Scala Theatre in Berlin, which was the most prestigious house. He played to packed houses. He could predict the future. He was known as the prophet of the Third Reich. He made a number of predictions. He predicted the Reichstag fire, for example, which bought Hitler. Hitler was appointed Chancellor of Germany in January, but he didn't actually manage to seize power, take total control, until he panicked the nation with the Reichstag fire in February. So he probably played a role in setting up this fire.
And what might Hitler have learnt from him, though, before the Reichstag fire? When was that? 34, I think.
Well, it looks like, the documentation, the Nazis were pretty good at trying to destroy everything. I mean, pretty much everybody who was involved in this story died.
Yeah.
That's the spoiler. Forster was either killed or took his own life. Was put on a show trial and forced to take his own life.
And that was the man who treated him initially. Then, so he knew about.
That was the doctor who treated him.
So he'd have known about Hitler's vulnerability. He'd have known about Hitler's. Yes. So in that way, he was a danger to the image of Hitler by then.
Well, absolutely, because according to research, which looks like that he tried to leak Hitler's medical file to a group of anti-fascist, anti-German émigré writers in Paris. He hoped they would publish the details of his hysterical breakdown, because he thought, the idea that their great leader had a mental breakdown, which shouldn't have had any effect on anybody. But I think we know even today, if a politician is kind of suspicious of having some kind of mental problem, we have such a prejudice against it that it might well prejudice your kind of political chances. So I think that's what Foster was hoping. He was saying, what else did he do? Well, he, for example, he taught Hitler how to use hypnosis. He taught him how to hypnotize crowds. He tells him, for example, that the best time to talk to people is at night, when their attention, your alertness level tends to be less at night very often. And so people kind of are more vulnerable to that kind of suggestion. And the use of music and lights and spectacle and the way in which you phrase things, and particularly the way you use body language to demonstrate the power of your words.
I mean, the fascinating thing about this is it's a way of looking at the rise of Hitler. Yes, of course, the history of the Times is important, the Wall Street crash. Yes, of course, the threat of Bolshevism, communism is very important. But also it's about Hitler the man, who transformed himself from this nobody into the kind of the Napoleon of the Nazis, if you like. And you're, I think, uniquely placed to do this as a writer, obviously, but also as a doctor, neuropsychologist, neuroscientist. So you explain to us the kind of the way that his mind was shaped through this. The book's subtitle, it's a fascinating read, folks, called Triumph of the Will, How Truman Hypnotised Hitler and Changed the World. Do you think there's any sense, I don't know a huge amount about hypnosis, but is there any sense in which there would have been a residue from his hypnotherapy, from his hypnotic treatment, that might have boosted that confidence to these megalomaniacal levels?
Well, absolutely, because when you put somebody into a hypnotic trance, I think the problem with hypnosis is people tend to think of it, as like in look into my eyes and,
And then bang, you're back in the room, it's all finished.
And back in the kind of, classic comic character. But in fact, all hypnosis is suggestion. It's putting people in a highly suggestible state. And having made a particular suggestion to them, you then need to remove that suggestion, what is called a post-hypnotic suggestion. You don't want to go through life with it, so you then tend to take it away again. Foster never did that. He just left it there. So, you know, probably until the day he died, he somehow believed that, you know, God was, well, I don't mean God in the sense of a divine
God. No, but
God,
destiny, or, almost, with a capital D.
Yes, that's right. The supernatural power was actually dictating his footsteps and telling him what to do, and whatever happened, he would well work out all right. And that's why he felt himself to be invisible. You know, he was never worried about being assassinated or being injured in a car crash or anything, simply because he felt he was under this protection, supernatural protection.
And I mean, I've read a lot about Hitler over the years, as has anybody interested in 20th century history, of course. He's at the heart of all that for all kinds of hideous reasons. But he does seem to have felt he was touched by destiny during the period of this treatment you've talked about. What do we know about this Dr. Edmund Forster? I know you said he was forced to effectively take his own life in the 30s.
Yeah, he was a very clever fellow. He was one of the most eminent nerve specialists in Germany at the time. He published a large number of books and papers. He was particularly interested in what they called hysteria. I mean, hysteria was just a label, like so often it is in mental illness, that they put on conditions they didn't understand. Because people who were hysterically disabled, I mean, they could be paralyzed, they could be deaf, they could be dumb, they could stutter, they could stammer.
And again, it's the symptoms of what they used to call shell shock, I suppose, as well, isn't it? It's that kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah, in fact, the British did call it shell shock. It was very often associated in people's minds with malingering. The British called it lack of moral fibre, LMF.
Yeah.
And they would shoot people for it. So the Germans were pretty brutal in the way they treated hysteria, but at least they did try and treat it. I mean, they didn't use much hypnosis because the German doctors weren't very good at hypnosis. So mostly they just gave people massive electric shocks.
And what happens when we are hypnotised, Dave? Is it possible to give us an overview of that from your scientific perspective?
When you go into an altered state of consciousness, if any of your listeners have been hypnotised, there's nothing unpleasant about it, nothing scary about it. You just kind of drift off into a world where you're still present in the world. You're kind of aware of very often what is going on, but somehow you're aware of other things as well. You're particularly aware of the therapist's voice, the hypnotist's voice, and you kind of are very open to suggestions. I mean, we all of us go into hypnosis, hypnotic states or altered states of consciousness several times a day. You know, you're gripped by a movie, for example, and for the time the movie lasts, you're transported to another world, world of the author and the actors. And you're reading a book, you're gripped in a novel or a thriller or a horror story. Again, this is another form of hypnosis, although, you know, people don't generally realise that. Well, it's just very interesting, but it's an altered state of consciousness.
And let me ask you as well, we know that Edmund Forster, Dr. Forster, died. It was believed to be suicide. Big question marks after that. He'd just been interviewed, interrogated by the Gestapo when his wife finds him in the bathroom dead. What happened to this man, Erik Jan Hannesson, that you mentioned, the kind of the Moravian Jewish guy masquerading as a clairvoyant, a Danish aristocrat, very famous. He ends up dead as well in mysterious circumstances, I think, doesn't he?
Well, not so mysterious. What happened was when he was on his way to the theatre, he was arrested by the Gestapo, by the SS, and taken to a secret prison there, or a small prison they had, where he was brutally interrogated. The thing of it was that he had lent a huge amount of money to the Sturmabteilung, the SA, the brown shirts.
Yeah.
And they were greatly in his debt, and they wanted to get the IOUs back. And so what they wanted to do was to persuade him to hand over all the IOUs. And finally he agreed, and they drove him back to his apartment, and they left him there. They took the IOUs, he showed them where they were, they took them all away. They left him there, but an hour or so later they came back and they dragged him back to the cells where they shot him three times at close range. But in the time he was left in his apartment, he wrote this extraordinary letter to a close associate. And it's like something for a fictional story, but it's true. He actually wrote it in invisible ink, so that when the SA came back to take him back to prison and kill him, they just saw a blank sheet of notepaper on the desk, and so they just ignored it. But in fact, it was his last letter in explaining what had happened, and that in it he said, I was cunning, but I wasn't as cunning as I thought, and I'm going to pay the price.
And then, of course, as a grim testament to the brutality, the savagery of the Nazis, within a year or so, the SA, the Brown Shirts, were also subject to the Night of the Long Knives themselves, and many of those men might have been killed by other Nazis.
And pretty much all the people who killed him were killed one way or the other. Particularly the people high in the SA, who were close to him, they were all gunned down.
The leader, Ernst Röhm, of course, who was also somebody that Hitler had known since the very early days, Hitler had no compunction in simply having him executed.
Absolutely not, no. I mean, anybody who stood in Hitler's way tended to pay the price, which was a high one. How do we know this? Because sadly, the medical files have never been discovered. Foster put them, Dr. Foster, the guy who treated him, put them in a Swiss bank vault where nobody, myself, journalists from the Spiegel, the German magazine, none of us have been able to find them. The reason we know about it is twofold. One is, the guy who first saw Hitler in the hospital before he passed him on to be treated by Foster, he was a Jewish doctor, and he was also arrested and sent to a Sachsenhausen concentration camp. But by amazing stroke of coincidences, he managed to escaped, and went to Iceland, where he lived in Iceland for the rest of the war with his family.
Wow!
And while he was there, he wrote a report, which is only recent, 30 years ago, was declassified for the American intelligence agencies about how he and Foster had treated Hitler for this hysterical blindness.
This new book is remarkable. It's called Triumph of the Will? And it talks about the two men who hypnotised Hitler and changed the world. It was 100 years ago last week that Adolf Hitler, as a corporal effectively, the little corporal as Churchill called him, was rushed to hospital supposedly blind, and you could say that was the beginnings of that dreadful, dreadful career. The book is a must read, as is David's earlier book on Hitler, The Man Who Invented Hitler, and that was Dr. David Lewis talking to me, Paul Ross, on Talk Radio. Fascinating.